Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast, something different today. In 2015, the ABC aired a gripping documentary series covering the tumultuous Rudd-Gillard era of government. This week, the series writer and interviewer Sarah Ferguson has released a book developed from the documentary. It includes previously untold information about the events of that period, as well as Ferguson's behind-the-scenes insights and stories about the key political players. Sarah Ferguson is our guest today. Sarah, thanks very much for talking with us. What were the challenges of doing a documentary project like this compared to your more usual investigative journalism?
There was a point reliving the material of the Killing Season series for this book where I remembered really precisely that moment of that difference between those two very different types of television, Michelle, and that is I longed really for a single villain or a single narrative that I could pursue to the ends of the earth. There was no single bad guy here.
You had too many or too few of them?
Too many, and no certainty as to who was the bad guy. That was the problem. And we're used to dealing with in a few more certainties in an investigative program. In this case, it was all about the impossible dream of finding a single truth. Now, I knew we could never find a single truth. I knew that either an approximation was the best we could hope for or a series of people's truths, versions of the truths laid out, and that through that the audience would come to pick a narrative that they tended to believe. But that was the thing. Every event had to be revisited. Every event had at least two and sometimes more than two versions of the truth within that event, and that was the fundamental difference.
Did your opinion of people change as you worked through the material and talked to people in more depth? Did you come to like some more, be more sympathetic to some, less sympathetic to others?
Sometimes my opinions would fluctuate wildly within a day, let alone over the course of making the series. We tended to find that the dominant narrative, that is good Julia, good Kevin, bad Kevin, that contest between those two ideas, ruthless Julia, Julia doing it in the national interest, Julia, and then the various Kevin narratives, we would move between the two depending sometimes on the last person we had spoken to. I was a feather for every wind that blew at certain times, lost my own certainties in the middle, and then we'd come out the other end and think, no, hang on, we're starting to get something like some consistency here. I came and went with people. So some of the people who you might regard as the most villainous in a way, as always with villains, tended to be the most charming. They didn't all turn up on camera, so of course sometimes the villains are their most attractive. But in fact, the people that I really came to like most in the end were, and this is perhaps self-serving, but there were those people who had thought very carefully about what they wanted to say, who took the proposition seriously that the voters deserved to know what really happened during this period. The Labour Party was so desperate to move on, as they are now, to show this great phalanx of unity that they now display to the voters. They were very reluctant to go back and explain what had happened, and I felt that they had to. So people like Ken Henry, Lachlan Harris was another, these were individuals who had gone away and thought about what had gone wrong during that period, what had caused these great tumultuous events in politics, and how much that had damaged good government during that time, and tried to figure out why. And the thing I liked about those people were that they always included themselves in the analysis. So instead of just blaming other people, they were prepared to say what their own failings were in letting the events of that period overwhelm good government and good policy. So those were, in the end, those were really my stars.
Was there a lot of content that couldn't or didn't get into the series that you put into this book?
Yes, a lot of content. And the reason for that is, in the course of making a series like this, you do an enormous amount of interviews. Now, I'm very happy to say I think we did 53 on-camera interviews and we used 50 of them. So we didn't have a ratio that blew out in terms of interviewing people that we didn't use. So very few people didn't make it into the series. Lindsay Tanner was one of them, which for kind of complicated reasons. But that meant, notwithstanding that everybody got something to say, or almost everyone, there was a great deal of material that we weren't able to use. And of course, television has its own rhythm. So television demands delivery, it demands drama. When you're watching the scene, for example, on the day of the leadership challenge, once Kevin Rudd has spoken to Wayne Swan, and they've had their moment of another friendship-ending moment for them, their own betrayals. Really, the drama goes out of the day. Now, you can have a little bit about what's happening in Gillard's office, but in a television program, you're really on to the next day. But of course, a lot more happened in the course of that day. So at every moment, there was a lot more to say than we were able to use. We had to hone it down. If you think about it, Michelle, the series really began in 2006, ended in 2013. It's three episodes. That's an enormous amount of ground. So a dramatic narrative that leaves lots of detail. It leaves lots and lots of stories that I loved. And in TV, we call it murdering our darlings. So you have to kill those grabs that you love the most and leave them aside. But this, in this case, it means that I could come back and look much more closely at the pivotal events.
You've also included plenty of detail about the hurdles of filming over several months. For example, having to keep hold of the jacket that Kevin Rudd was wearing so you could create a seamless string of interviews. Tell us a bit about those sorts of difficulties.
Not just Kevin Rudd's jacket, and we were, I think, very wise to take his jacket and tie away really as hostages to fortune. I'm not sure his jacket was going to make him come back, but I felt that it created a twitch upon the thread if we had his jacket hanging in our wardrobe, that it was our totem. He was going to come back, because the great fear throughout the whole series was that Kevin would walk. So at least we had his jacket. We felt that eventually there'd be a body to come back and fill the jacket. It wasn't just his jacket, it was my jacket. So we started the interviews in these are small details, but they come to matter. So we started filming in Boston in the winter, and I'm wearing a heavy purple jacket that I had to wear every day, because you can't wash a big thick jacket in a hotel sink in Boston in the middle of winter. So anyway, don't get too close to that question. But I had to wear the same clothes when we resumed the interviews in Sydney in January, when it was about 39 degrees. So I'm wearing a very tight, close-knitted, purple, hot jacket, which Kevin Rudd said maybe looked like a member of the Star Trek crew. But, you know, that's Kevin Rudd. Most female reporters wouldn't appreciate.
Diplomatic at all points.
Actually, I always felt he had a point, so I didn't get too cranky about that. But all of these things come into your thinking, because of course you're telling a visual story. So at all times you're thinking about the analysis of what's happening, the drama of how you're going to tell it, and of course the reconstructions done here in Parliament House. And I haven't been back in Parliament since we did those reconstructions. So it's a happy day to be with you again. It was a very happy series to make.
Now, both Rudd and Gillard, of course, are expert media operators. And you talk a little bit about the difficulties of getting past their defensive mechanisms. How were they different in this way?
A completely different approach, the two of them, and different approaches work in order to draw either of them out. Now, both of them are very conscious of their own skills. But what nobody is prepared for is what happens over hours and hours of interviews. Now, as we know, our politicians are highly trained in answering, not answering questions, delivering messages, delivering lines. But none of them are prepared for what happens over 10 hours. You can't consistently tell a story that is not entirely true, or is a version of a story, or shaped to suit you over a long period of time. Eventually, inconsistencies, if there are any, will creep in. You can't maintain the facade that you use in a studio interview over 10 hours. So something very, very different happens, but they approached it very differently. Julia Gillard, I think what she was doing was doing her best to answer, but absolutely within the framework of what she wanted to say. She had a very clear idea of her narrative, which is Kevin Rudd's incapacity, Kevin Rudd's inability to cope with being Prime Minister made her taking the Prime Ministership an inevitable thing. No alternative. It could only end that way. And she didn't want to go outside of that framework. And the closer she got to the questions around her own decision, her own ambition, the less precise her language becomes. This is a technique of Gillard's that I came to be aware of, which is a falling off the point. So you ask a question and she'll give you an answer that appears to be in the same area, but actually manages to round out the subject and take it just a little bit away from the core, and you have
to get
out the gate, and you have to notice what she's doing to bring her back to the topic at hand. What Kevin Rudd does, he is a master at television interviews. We know that sometimes he became very prolix, and in fact I think he's When he becomes prolix, I become suspicious of him. When his clauses mount up, one subordinate clause on top of another, language ever more complex, I think you're getting further and further from the truth. But he remains a very effective media operator. And in fact, our researcher who was sitting in on the interviews at one point when we were reaching the back end, that is after the pivot, so you have Julia Gillard pursues to an extent Kevin Rudd, and then the whole story changes, and then it's Kevin Rudd pursuing Julia Gillard. In that period, he repeated the same answers over and over and over again, not allowing me any, trying to stop me from getting into that corral of I didn't do it, it was all her fault. And the researcher, when we took a break to change the cards in the camera, just said, I can't stand it anymore. I can't stand the way he's saying the same thing over and over. And I said, no, that is Kevin Rudd's very particular skill. He's not giving me any material that I can use to change the narrative of what he's saying. The more he says it, I'm not going to use his repetitions, but he's not giving me anywhere to go. I've got to find a way to disrupt that very well-crafted narrative. He wanted to control what was happening in those interviews. Gillard wanted to endure them, finish them, and get out.
So in a sense, you were fighting, he was fighting you as well as fighting Gillard.
That was very clear from the beginning, that he wanted to master the rhythm of the interviews. And because if you know anything about Kevin Rudd, you know that trust is one of the central issues in Kevin Rudd's life. And if I had set it up entirely as combat, I would have got absolutely nowhere, because he'll fight you until the end of the day, and he'll keep fighting after you've fallen. I thought that the way through to at least some knowledge about Kevin Rudd was really to get him to trust me. So early on, I didn't interrupt him a great deal. The interruptions came later because we still had to get through the material. But while we were working each other out, I let him express himself in the way he wanted. But I watched the way he tried to bring me back constantly to the version of the interviews that he wanted. And eventually I had to take that control from him, but not immediately.
So given your knowledge of how he operates, I wonder how you now see his campaign to get to the UN job.
If it's possible for someone in their 50s to have a classic modus operandi, there it is. Cards very close to his chest, doesn't declare. Constant denial indeed, but working furiously behind the scenes with a almost moment-by-moment analysis of where the competing candidates are up to. And you know, as Wayne Swan recognised, the man has champion networking skills unlike anybody, certainly anybody Wayne Swan had ever met, and I think for most of us that would be the case. And this is one of the great, I think one of the most fascinating things about Kevin Rudd is that he understands those relationships so well. He understands them probably on the international stage better than in any other environment. And yet when he became Prime Minister, he didn't use those connections. He used the connections to get him to the job, but he felt that once he was there, he no longer had to maintain them. It's a line that I think Paul Howes uses, that this is the, you know, he says it's the $64 million question. How could you have someone who so understands the way the Labour Party works and then get into power and throw away all of that understanding? If it was a scene in the West Wing or House of Cards, you wouldn't believe it.
What do you think about this quality of being willing to deny what's patently the truth that does seem to have run through his career?
Well, it creates a sort of nonsense. It's as if there's a as if by repeating it often enough, people will believe it. And I think the problem is that he's so effective, and he understands the way the media works so well, and he understands very precisely how it works. I'll give you an example in a moment of that, actually. But I think that he can keep doing it because he gets away with it, because he does it so well and so effectively that people don't have enough tools in their armory, enough arrows in their, what's that thing called that holds the arrows? They don't have the weapons to come back and take it apart. He gets away with it, and as long as he gets away with it, he's going to keep doing it. When we were in Boston, I saw that skill on display. We wanted to film him alone, so he was teaching at Harvard. And the scene of him surrounded by milling students, oblivious to the fact that this was a former prime minister, he's just one of their professors around them. And we wanted to film him alone in that scene, in the really those beautiful, elegant alleyways of Harvard Square. and he refused to be filmed alone. He saw immediately what we were trying to do, which is to portray him as a lonely exile, and he refused to be shown in that way. He had a young PhD student called Jing who was with him all the time, and he insisted that Jing be in all of the shots and talking to him in Mandarin, even though Jing spoke perfectly good English, which meant that the image that we wanted to display as setting him up of the lonely exile, lost, gone from power, we couldn't achieve. We never got it.
How did he explain that to you?
Just like that. I know exactly what you're doing. You want to show me as a lonely exile. He could have read it from our pre-production notes. I'm not going to let you do that. Jing's going to be with me in every shot. So he just called it for what it was. It's just, you know, Tony Burke said the thing that was so extraordinary about him in 2006 and 2007, and again, the questions that come are, you know, why these skills desert people when they get into the office of Prime Minister. Hello, Malcolm Turnbull. This was someone who could perform from, you know, sunrise to late line. He could be talking about nuclear non-proliferation on late line in the evening and doing the Macarena on the breakfast show, and nobody else could command that full, the full spectrum of media in the way that he could. And he, that understanding in him is very acute. Didn't always stay with him when he was Prime Minister.
Now, Julia Gillard, you mentioned she has a narrative that she sticks to, that she had no alternative but to rescue the nation and the party and the government from this man. To what extent do you think she had other motives, that she was driven by other considerations?
And by that, do you mean her own political ambitions?
Yes.
Yes. I think this is the central and most interesting question around Gillard. What she does very skillfully is lay the groundwork for the narrative that you just described. So she sets up what she was doing in terms of helping Kevin Rudd until the moment when it was too late and she had to step in. She lays this groundwork very carefully. She does it around Copenhagen, particularly skillfully, where prior to Copenhagen, she sets up his connection to Copenhagen as being emotional, so that when Copenhagen fails, she can say he had an emotional breakdown. In fact, she really describes it as a mental breakdown. I think she goes way, way, way too far at that point, and it certainly angered a lot of her colleagues and made some of them, including Chris Bowen, take part in order to reject that. But she doesn't just say it, that she went to see him in January of 2010 and felt that he was in the grip of a breakdown. She lays the groundwork for that by describing how he was in the lead up. But I think this is quite, this is an artful narrative. I think it's her way of arriving at the point where she has to act, where coping, his incapacity and his inability to cope are established as features of him before she steps in. And that's what she does. So the question for me was all about where her ambition comes in. She didn't stalk him like Kevin Rudd did in the way that he plotted. Let's say, I don't like the word stalk, let's say the way he discussed and plotted his return. She didn't do that. But at the same time, the question as to what was going on in her mind when all of those people came in to see her to talk about leadership, you know there's something going on, because she starts adopting this very oblique language, and you know there's something up with Gillard. And I have, what I said in the book is that I sensed it before I really understood it, that when she can be, as you know, she can be clinical, she's transactional, she's detailed, she's fact-based. When she talks about her own motivation, what you hear is mist, shadow boxing, smoke and mirrors. There's no language of precision. It all goes away and it gets covered in this mist. Jerry Kitchener, her staffer, punctured it, a very old friend of hers, who said, no, she didn't agitate, but she could have told those people to stop, and she didn't, which enabled all of that thinking and the plotting and whatever the planning to go on. And I think this is the question, because she wants to say, what she's done is create a narrative, which I don't think it's a credible narrative, that she, it all came to her on the day. Now, interestingly, I found an interview that my colleague Liz Jackson had done at Four Corners with her in the year after she became Prime Minister, in which she said that she had thought about it over a long period of time. She came to it over a long period of time. And when I quoted that, her own line back to her, she said, I didn't say it. And I said, well, you did. Here's the exact quote. And she continued to say, I don't think I would have said that. And I think what had happened is that she's shaped that narrative to a point where it's reached a point that stretches credulity, which is the one where she doesn't think about it. She didn't need to make it so extreme. I think people would perfectly understand that she considered it. And if you have a stream of people coming in to see you to ask you about leadership, you're going to be thinking about it. You don't need to have only thought about it on the day. So Anthony Albanese talks about her as always having been ambitious. There's a nice story that is in the book that she, when she won the Labourship ticket from Kevin Rudd, she actually asked, if requested that she sit next to him at the dispatch box. She thought it was time to change it up, that it should no longer be Prime Minister versus opposition leader, that the deputy should sit next to the opposition leader at the dispatch box. And Kevin Rudd said, I thought that was quite a good idea, which I didn't really believe. But anyway, the party said no. So Jenny Matlin said the same thing, that she had, you know, believed that Julia, if she didn't hand over the deputy leadership to her in 2006, that Gillard would just keep going. So plenty of her colleagues who admire her talk about how powerful her ambition was. I think she's locked herself into a narrative that cuts out ambition as being an element and makes it all about Kevin Rudd, but that is a narrative, it's not the whole truth.
Now, the party, of course, has moved on, and Bill Shorten now is the centre of attention. He was at the heart of much of these events, and yet he was one of the people who was very shy of talking.
He was very shy of talking. We went for dinner in a restaurant in Canberra and sat behind a screen, which I thought was the perfect metaphor for really how his attitude towards the documentary. What I think Bill Shorten was doing, one of the things he was doing, was that he wanted the archive to be clean. He wanted there to be no grabs, no lines, no unfortunate answer with an emphasis here or there that would hurt him, that could be used against him. He's done a very good job of keeping himself out of that story. He's been very effective. And the party helps him by, in their own way, I talked about phalanxes earlier, but the party also formed a phalanx around him. So people with perfectly good memories would talk about Mark Arbib with no problem at all. They'll talk about David Feeney. They'll talk about Don Farrell, all of the agitators. But when it comes to Bill Shorten, their memories suddenly become terribly hazy and they can't really remember whether he was, you know, in the room or not. So one of the things we were able to do in the book is to go back and insert Bill Shorten into all of those key moments. For example, remember that famous footage of him in the restaurant, in the Vietnamese restaurant on the night, and he has gone to great lengths to say that he was talking to his school teacher, the teacher of his child, and I'm sure he was talking to the teacher of his child, but the staff say he was also ringing them in increasing desperation, ending with him saying, "Can I swear in your podcast?" saying, "If she doesn't do it, we're all fucked." And that has the ring of truth about it, that Shorten, as I said, gone to great lengths to remain in the shadows, but there are too many people with too many recollections of Bill Shorten for him to be removed entirely from the, well, certainly he's in the heart of the drama. Even himself, when we kept going back to him to ask if he would take part, and I think it's a legitimate question. He's at the centre of the events and he's the leader. I want to know what Bill Shorten thinks about the exercise of power and what his, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea to do what he did in 2010. I understand why he wants a clean archive, but I don't think he's entitled to it as the leader, necessarily. He wrote us a letter right at the end when we made our last attempt to get him to take part. And he said he'd been criticised for not explaining his reasons, he said to us, for not voting for Julia Gillard in 2010, and he'd made sure not to make the same mistake in 2013. I actually looked at that letter again today, and something in it that I hadn't noticed before, which is, he says, I was criticised for not explaining why I voted for Julia Gillard in 2010. The question is not why he voted for Julia Gillard in 2010. The question is why he played such an important and active role in getting rid of a first-term prime minister. But this is what he does. He just wants to step away from the centre of the events and remain in the cloisters underneath the arch, half in shadow.
So when you look at him now as the opposition leader, in light of your experience with him and what you know of him, what do you think? What do you see?
I would like to know to what extent Bill Shorten has evolved from that point. He was he was new to federal politics. He obviously was someone who came into federal politics, like all of his co-conspirators there, with a great deal of power in the party, but new to federal politics. How has his understanding of the operation of power and the purpose of power in politics evolved since then? I don't doubt that it has evolved, but I would still like to have that conversation with him. And I think that there's no reason why the voters shouldn't be entitled to hear him explain it. He must have a good explanation for it now. So why can't we get to hear it? It shouldn't be in the locked off section of the British Museum.
Well, presumably if the media are doing their jobs during this election campaign, we'll get some answers to some of these questions, unless he's very clever indeed.
Well, the problem with election campaigns, if they're anything like the last couple, is that because they're so obsessed with, you know, obviously minutiae is a problem, but the daily moves, that going back in time can seem like reaching back too far.
Are you suggesting we'll have to wait for another series to get to the real truth? Sarah Ferguson, thank you very much for talking with us today, and good luck with the book. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again soon. This is Michelle Grattan.